Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. The next concert for your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra features just two works, but what great works they are. Here to talk about them is Ward Steer. Ward, welcome back.
Hi, Julia.
Your RPO music director and pianist Jeremy Denk is back in town. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks.
So let's start with the first big one, which is the Berlioz. Never done. Rarely done. It's just originally, it was like this massive choral work. Very expensive. Very expansive. Have you ever, Ward, seen this, the whole thing done?
I've never seen it done live. No, I mean, it's an hour and a half long or plus. I mean, it's like 95 minutes or something if you do the whole thing. So it's rare that you hear the entire thing in one evening, although I would love to do it with chorus and the whole nine yards. But we're doing the three big scenes from kind of part two. Which make for nice concert pieces. And often, you know, you'll hear just the love scene, or you'll hear maybe Queen Mab, Scherzo on its own. But the three, and, you know, the big scene at the Capulets, and which starts with Romeo alone, putting the three together, I think, works pretty well. And it makes for about 45 minutes, which is a good half of a concert. So something that I wanted to do very much. And I'm a huge Berlioz fan, and it's great music, really great music.
Everything but the kitchen sink on this one.
It's, yeah, I mean, he he certainly wanted to always push the barriers and, you know, explore new boundaries, I guess, when he was writing. This is, of course, his third symphony. He didn't like to number his symphonies. You know, Symphony Fantastique was the first, and Harold in Italy is his second symphony. His third symphony is this. He called it a dramatic, I think he called it a dramatic symphony, actually, even though he used chorus. So obviously there's a big influence of Beethoven here with Beethoven's Ninth, but the Shakespeare influence is, of course, the main thing, and he was a great lover of Shakespeare his whole life.
In fact, this particular piece was inspired by the very same woman that inspired the Symphonie Fantastique.
And it's interesting. Berlioz was such a character. I mean, if you read his memoirs or the, you know, Evenings at the Orchestra, or there are a lot of great biographies about him by authors, you know, and it's just he's fascinating as a person. And yes, Harry, but I say that because I recently read that I think it's in his memoirs, but he talks about how, yes, that first performance of Shakespeare that he saw with Harriet Smithson, which was, of course, you know, what drew him to her, and he ended up writing the Symphonie Fantastique to seduce her, which he was ultimately successful at, but the relationship didn't last. You know, we've all heard that story. But then he said much, much later that, you know, believe it or not, the person who inspired the love theme in the love scene in Romeo and Juliet was not her. He was thinking of someone else. He said that, I think, after they weren't together anymore.
So what a cad.
I know. So it's very interesting. But
Romantics had to be cad.
That's right.
What's that?
Romantics had to be cad. That's part of the requirement.
Yeah, I mean, he's just... he was a zany guy, but he was thinking about writing something for Romeo and Juliet for many years. And, you know, while he was in Italy, he had a lot of inspiration, and he heard, I think it was the Capuletti Montecchi, Bellini, while he was there, and he hated it. He thought it was a terrible realization musically of the story. And one of the things that he remarked about, I think when he was talking to Mendelssohn or talking about a conversation he had with Mendelssohn, was he said, I don't know why no one has ever written music for Mercutio's Queen Mab, you know, speech, because that's one of the most interesting parts, or at least it was to Berlioz, in the entire drama. And then I guess after he said that, he then took it back and he said, well, I hope no one's ever written it. Maybe Mendelssohn's done it. And he sort of lived in fear for a while that someone else had written it, but then he took it upon himself. And the Queen Mab Scherzo is really, it's very tricky for the orchestra, the way it's written, the way it's barred. You have to be quite nimble. And it's also, I think it's in the memoirs, or maybe it's in something else that Berlioz wrote, but he remarked that for a lot of this music, you have to know it so well. He said, first of all, don't attempt it if you don't have a great orchestra and a great conductor, and you have to have enough rehearsal. You have to know it well enough that you practically do know it by heart, because the music just, it goes by in the blink of an eye, and it's got to be very light and playful, so you can't be stressed out about it. You have to enjoy it, but it's really... difficult to execute properly, so it's a good challenge for us this week.
And Berlioz himself said that the love scene was one of his own favorite pieces.
Oh yeah, the love time. It's and mine too. I mean, when you forget just how gorgeous this music is, and it's the way he uses the colors in the orchestra is marvelous. I mean, there are long extended passages with mutes for the strings, which is unusual because if you look in the score, it says, you know, fortissimo appassionato, you know, this really intense playing, but all the while there's a mute on, and that's actually intentional because there's an added color, there's an added layer of tension that's created when you're playing, you know, full out fortissimo on a string instrument with the mute still on, and it gives this wonderful tension. It's just the best, you know, that's perfect for the situation with the young love and the anticipation and everything, and it's delightful.
And what is the third of the movements that we'll hear?
The third movement is, it starts with Romeo alone, and it's sort of pensive. It's very much, actually, if you know Wagner well, you know Tristan, you'll recognize the link there. Interestingly enough, when Berlioz first performed Romeo in Paris, Wagner, it was right after Wagner arrived in Paris, and Wagner saw that performance and was really struck by it. And many years later, after he wrote Tristan, he sent Berlioz, or I think it was around the same time, but he sent Berlioz a note or a gift. I can't remember exactly what it was, but the inscription read, for the composer of Romeo and Juliet from the composer of Tristan, because so those two pieces were very much linked in Wagner's mind, and he wanted Berlioz to know how much he inspired him.
This was all paid for by Paganini.
That's right, because he thought Berlioz was the next Beethoven, and he was just amazed by his talent and his vision. So he left him a considerable chunk of change right before he died. Paganini did, and so Berlioz was able to just sort of go wild with this project. And so thank you, Paganini.
Yeah, thank you for many things, but most of all for this thing, right, which was an immediate success, unlike the next piece on the program, the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 1 with our soloist Jeremy Denk. This one, it took 3 attempts before anybody wrote a good review on it.
No, really? Yeah, I forgot the early... Of course, Brahms was a young man then, right? He had not yet established himself as the statesman of music and the representative of a whole ethos. And, you know,
that's right.
He was virtues.
He was very hot, too.
He was sexy. You know, he wasn't the fat, cigar-smoking man that you see in the later portraits. charming, of course, later Brahms. But early Brahms, he was a force to be reckoned with.
So let's talk about this piece of music that you'll be playing. It's a very dramatic open, and it's almost 4 minutes before we even hear the piano mm-hmm. play at all. Big open.
Well, and you know that this piece, it started kind of as a 2-piano sonata, I think, and then he was going to write a symphony because he had been encouraged to write a symphony by many people for a long time, and he couldn't really, he just couldn't get it together in terms of the form and what he wanted it to be, and it took many, many years and many, many tries before he finally settled on the fact that it would be a piano concerto. But the music that you hear in the opening was inspired right around the time that Schumann tried to kill himself, and so you hear that intensity and that kind of, you know, how Brahms was just, his world was kind of rocked when that happened because, you know, he loved Schumann so much and he was like a part of the family. And of course, the relationship between he and Clara got even more, got deeper and more complicated years after that. But in the very beginning, you hear that intensity, that that shock of having that experience, seeing his friend deteriorate and attempt suicide. And then from there, you know, we go through this very complicated first movement that's, you know, the first movement itself is about the length of a lot of concertos.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
It's actually, 23 minutes.
It's an astonishing achievement, the first one, actually.
Yeah.
And it's in that vein, you know, Brahms was a young man. If you look at Brahms' opuses, the first 10 or so, he gives you comfort because he's a great genius. But he wrote a lot of hot messes in the early, yeah? There a lot of disasters and form and continuity and the unification of all. He had amazing, deeply romantic, vivid ideas, incredible tunes. He had a great gift for tunes always. Mm-hmm. And then, but he didn't yet have that sense of how to tie it all together. And this first movement is like, look at me, I'm going to tie this massive epic poem together. And you're right, it's very dark and tragic. He had a sort of a thing for the Norse epics, you know, jagged fjords, stormy seas, you know, and that's how it begins with the orchestra, this sort of jagged idea, and then it settles into this dark, you know, and it's all about dark and lights, and then it erupts again, and then finally the piano comes in, supplying, and that's the great genius of him, that supplying the one thing that the entire opening 2D had missed, you know, which right. was so big, but this sort of beautiful lilting lyricism when the piano comes in, right? And it there it is, and I had a sense of the flow of the thing. And then, you know, there's a tremendous amount of thematic material in that first movement, all incredibly different, and he somehow puts gorgeous transitions, no messy transitions, all beautiful, and especially you could tell he was thinking about how do I link between the materials, how do I metamorphose the ideas, you know, these ideas that... It is one tragic idea at the beginning, right? That idea. When it becomes a gypsy, and it becomes a little waltz. Right? In every way, he and so tremendous imagination, inventiveness, and then craft beginning to get born. And there's no mystery why it wasn't a success at the beginning, because it's big. It's a big piece. It's way too long for a normal piano concerto, right? And it's colossally conceived. It's very hard to follow it from beginning to end, and I'm sure it presented a big challenge.
And then we move into that second movement, and the second movement is just beautiful. And the second movement also does what rarely happens, which is to give the lead line to the bassoon.
There's a lot of beautiful wind writing, actually, in the second movement. There really is. Yeah, they come in with these Schubertian. Yeah, a lot of the opening, the main material of the solo movement is religioso, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of chorale, you know, like long lines and scales, just hearing the beauty of D major scales. And then, but in the middle, this kind of Schubertian tune comes, and the clarinets have it, and it sings in minor and then in major, and he does all the Schubert tricks. But it's beautiful. Beautiful orchestral writing, actually, in general.
And in that second movement, he uses these small wind groups to offset the fact that you, Jeremy, play solo a lot.
In the second movement. It's very much they play and then I play. Yeah.
And it's a dialogue, kind of, in a way.
Yeah. And very, there's wonderful moments where the strings play these very hushed chorales, right? Just a bar or two of almost silent, almost inaudible beauty. And then the piano comes in with something even more unearthly in a way, right? With the beautiful hemiolas and the triplets and the sort of everything begins to, if the opening idea is kind of quarter by quarter, beat by beat, then the piano is allowed to kind of disintegrate the beat and wander around it and stretch the sense of time and do things that only pianists can do because we're just there by ourselves, you know? We don't have to be together with anyone.
Right.
Well, it's interesting to imagine also, you know, Brahms and Clara playing through that at one point, you know, which I'm sure they did it. I mean, they did that a lot. And some of the accounts, if you read, you know, Clara about playing chamber music with Brahms, she used to get really frustrated with him because he couldn't keep a steady tempo. She said he was so impetuous. He would, you know, rush with the crescendos and, you know, slow down with the diminuendos and everything else in between. And she would say it was just, he was a great musician, but it was so frustrating sometimes to stay
That makes him my hero.
That's right. Me too. it's an
excuse. But Clara was a totally different... She was buttoned up and classical. Oh, yeah. She liked things to be in their place. And Brahms, the music of Brahms, including this piece, is always about this sort of tension between, you know, a tension in one sense between deep romantic expressivity and restraint on the other side, and also classical proportion, and then romantic wildness, the gypsy in him versus the German, good German musician, if you know what I mean.
And then we finish off with the third movement, and this is, it's sprightly, it's kind of a
it's perfect. It's actually there's not a better movement, I think, in a more joyful movement in the whole piano concerto repertoire. And he stole it from Beethoven. He took Beethoven's third rondo from the last movement of the C minor concerto. He took it and he's like, I'm going to do that, but I'm going to do it better, and he did. He did. Unbelievably. You know, the tune is very similar, but there's a fugue in the middle, which is even more clever and inventive and Mendelssohnian. It doesn't feel like one of these stodgy things. And then he builds this, you know, it's a rondo. It's got a good gypsy tune in D minor. Then it has a gorgeous second theme that's quite different. And then there's stormy episodes. And then at the end, he builds this, takes us into D major. And there's a series of different tempos, right? Mm-hmm. Different kind of elations, you know, building to this glorious finish.
Joyful.
Yeah, it's joyful, beyond joyful, and especially it's so much of a relief after all the darkness of the first movement and the thoughtfulness of the second movement, and then just the gypsy joy of it.
Kicking out the jams, as it were.
Kicking out the jams, yeah.
There is a two-piano version of this. Have you ever played it?
No, I haven't played it. People keep referring to it, and I feel like an idiot for not knowing about it or having looked at it. But, that would be tough because so much of the music in the first movement, especially, is orchestral by nature, right? The main idea is when the piano has to play it, it's a little bit like, well, I'm just playing it, but the orchestra can do this so much better than me. Yeah.
Now, pianists are kind of torn on Brahms as a composer. He was a great pianist himself. Some pianists say, God, he's a hot mess. It's so hard to play him.
Really? What piano? Who are these?
Who are these people?
Dubious people.
Does he fit your hands well?
Oh, Brahms had big... Yeah, he fits my... Yeah, sure.
Does he fall... As you play him, you don't feel that it's unnecessarily difficult?
Awkward?
Awkward,
you know, sometimes
yes.
You wish it had more silly arpeggios so you could just have a great time. But he doesn't do that, you know. And when he's difficult, it's very difficult. It's very kind of a craggy, kind of a little bit weightier. You know, it doesn't have the Chopin-esque kind of... in Chopin, you know, he always knows what overtones to activate so to make your life easier. So the piano kind of begins to play itself. And in Brahms, it doesn't do that. You have to be connected to the meaning of the harmony and sort of build the story from that a little bit more like at the lumber bench, just, you know, you're just making the stuff, you know, making it work. And so I could see why some pianists might feel frustrated by that. But for me, it feels very grateful. You know, the problem in this piece is the orchestra is loud, right? And the piano, and they should be loud. And the piano is often accompanying the orchestra too, right?
So, yeah. Just getting the mix and the balance.
The mix is a little tricky.
Tricky,
yeah.
But...
So you mentioned, Jeremy, that he was a young man when he wrote this. He was 25 and strutting his stuff. Do either of you, both of you, see hints inside of this of the greatness that was to come? Those symphonies that were just around the corner, but not yet. The things that he was going to do, the Requiem. Do you see any of that inside of this piece?
I don't see it that way. I mean, it is... I wouldn't say it's the apogee of perfection, but I think it's pretty high up up there. Maybe the first movement's a little long, but it's not a greatness to come. It's a greatness for me that's already there. I mean, nobody wrote a tune as amazing as the second theme in the first movement, or when the piano comes in the first movement. The inspiration level is just off the charts. I don't know. That's my perspective on it. And it feels very much like later Brahms is in there. It may be just a little wilder, a little more gypsy, a little more craggy.
So why did he have so much difficulty writing that first symphony? If he's written this with all of its beauty and perfection, wildness and coolness, why was that symphony so darn difficult?
Well, you know, he was his own worst enemy in a sense, because he was very, very critical of himself. I mean, he told his housekeeper that the most important piece of furniture in his entire apartment was the wastebasket, you know, which is true, because he threw out so much. You know, I remember the first time I did the Schicksalslied and the Gesang der Parzen, and, you know, he actually wrote more vocal music than anything else. Did you know that?
But he
destroyed it. So we don't know about it. You know, you have to really dig deep to find out about that. But he was such a perfectionist. And, you know, he also composed and practiced. His apartment in Vienna had a huge bust of Beethoven literally, you know, hovering over him on the piano. So he didn't, you know, psychologically do himself any favors either. Where
well,
that
the whole
was
19th century had that problem, right? But Beethoven was the daddy they could never, satisfy.
And
somehow.
He was so conscious of also his place in history, because he was a student of the past. I mean, he was very into, you know, Renaissance music, old manuscripts. I mean, he really loved that. So he was always worried about where he would fit in to the lineage. And so, I mean, I think that's part of why he waited so long to release his first symphony. But going back to your original question, I think I agree with what Jeremy said in the sense that it is a masterpiece already, and the fact that he was able to tame and corral all these really passionate, wild ideas and make them work so beautifully is the mark of a true genius, and the craftsmanship with which he puts together this entire concerto is just marvelous, and that certainly is evident, you know, in the throughout the course of his four symphonies and a lot of his other later works, but it's already here in the first concerto.
Let's say he got more concise, right? A lot of wise people, as they approach their 30s and 40s, they begin to say a little bit less and focus it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that what he had to say was any more beautiful later, in a sense.
Except for that theme in the first symphony.
Well, there are many beautiful themes all through Brahms. It's just that, also I feel that way about the sextet, you know, the early B-flat sextet, which is around this time, right? Mm. I love that piece, and it just pours out tunes, you know, one more beautiful than the last. And I don't know, I like Brahms at that time. You know, it's different, but it's not, it doesn't feel to me like lesser. Mm. Like, yeah.
You do a lot of research. You really are very meticulous in your research, Jeremy. When you started to research this piece, the first time you ever approached it, what were your discoveries that helped you out in working with it, in wrestling it to the ground?
I think you're giving me too much credit as far as research. I mean, sometimes I do research particular things, and I'm not sure that I ever felt that this piece needed research. It just needed love, you know? and I loved it from a very young age, you know, when I first heard it. And it's one of those pieces that kind of knocked me out. I had a little cassette of Rubinstein doing it or whatever in my little boom box. I'd play it in my tiny little bedroom with my stuffed animals or whatever. And so I knew it, you know, from a very, and I loved every little harmonic moment in it and the tunes, you know. So I guess I didn't, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what I think the pacing ought to be, especially maybe in the first movement, and how do you tie the whole thing together, which is tricky because it is rather longer than maybe ideal, but the ideas that he had were long breathes. So how do you make them work? How do you create that sense? It's a tension between the spaciousness of the ideas and the need of the narrative to go forward. And you have to kind of ride that line a little bit.
How do you pace yourself? You got a lot of work that you have to do.
I'm going to the gym later, so I'll do that. And I eat my vegetables. And otherwise, when you're playing Brahms, it's about weight, arm weight and relax. When you watch him, when you see the portraits of him playing, it's like his arm is just sort of, it's just gravity, right? And so as far as possible, when you're playing Brahms, you have to have gravity on your side.
You won the MacArthur Grant in 2014. They said, you'll love this, they said that Jeremy, enlivening the musical experience for amateurs and aficionados alike through his eloquence with notes and words. Yeah, I know. It's pretty hefty. So what did you do with the money?
I haven't done anything with it yet. I put it in the bank.
Didn't you see the Ferrari he
pulled
up in there?
Yeah. I was supposed to come up with a great idea for it. And you know, I'd love to come up with a project for it. And unfortunately, I already had many projects in the fire already that I can barely keep up with, including a book that I'm supposed to finish. So hopefully my editor won't track me down and kill me while I'm here. So until I you know, sort of clear the deck a little bit, I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
What is the book that you're writing?
I did a piece for The New Yorker about my piano teacher in Bloomington, a kind of a love letter to him, George Szybak, who was an amazing figure, Hungarian kind of Yoda of the piano. And so I wrote a piece about that, and it was about piano lessons, I guess, in general. And it seemed to have struck a nerve. People liked it, and so they wanted me to expand it into a larger, cool, you know, a pianist memoir / piano lessons / whatever I used to do on the blog when I had time for blogging.
So what was your teacher like?
Szybak, he did look like Yoda. He smoked in every music school I ever saw illegally, this magnificent long-handled European cigarette. He was a person of incredible class and refinement and nuance, and he used the most beautiful images for things. And he opened up, you know, my concept of many things to be, you know, beauties that I had never suspected. Like even in Mozart, you know, he'd sort of tap along the harmonic rhythm in Mozart, and you'd be listening to a harmony, go to another harmony, go to another harmony, go back and forth. And then suddenly Mozart would elongate the harmonic rhythm, right? Send it adrift so there'd be like 12 bars, and he would just send you, then he would make you notice how the suddenly everything went aloft. And he had a way of describing and creating those moments that you found things in the music you never imagined. And he could be a real pain also. He said he was very good at insults also. You know, like once I played for him the Eroica variations, and I was very proud of how I'd played because I managed, it's a hard piece. And he looked at me and he said, "You need to learn the difference between character and caricature." And then, ouch. And he was good. He was good with the quick takedown.
Did you know what he meant when he said that?
Of course,
that?
Yeah. As a kid, you know. I ended up, that's in the piece, in the New Yorker piece, is that, you know, I ended up loving him so much that it was almost dangerous. You know, that I just idolized him as a musician. And I had to, after a while, you have to leave these teachers, no matter what they gave you. Yeah.
When you went on to teach yourself, what of his did you take with him for your students?
Well, I tried to take with him, he was very beautiful at explaining how, and conductors know all about this actually, how you have to match the movement of the arms, you have to match your movement to the musical gesture. Yeah? Otherwise, you're wasting motion all around the corners. To find the perfect minimum movement that becomes the musical phrase, you know? And he was so good at that, and purging unnecessary motions. And he was all about where's the ups and where are the downs in music. So the music feels settled when it needs to, and it flows to the next thing when it needs to. And so I hope I took that from him. Yeah.
What about you, Ward? What teacher sort of put your head on the map?
Oh, boy. I've had the benefit of so many great teachers, great mentors. I mean, when I remember, but boy, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to answer you concisely because, you know, we could talk about this for hours. But I think one thing, when I was a trombone player, I was at Juilliard, and there were so many great resources there. And I remember, I think the key to my success early on, and you know, when I got the job in Chicago and all that, when I was so young, was I had a teacher who really could. I mean, just the technique. It was absolutely, there's no question, you know, that this was a good method that he used, and he could get you to play the instrument. But then that wasn't enough. You also needed the music and the concepts and things like that, like kind of like what Jeremy was just talking about with the imagery and how things connect. And so I was able to get both those things, but not from the same source, which is interesting. So, you know, like then when I would teach later, I would always tell my students, and, you know, I never had a full-time position at any university or anything like that. It was mostly just, you know, one-off, you know, private lesson situations or master classes. But I always tell students, you know, the most important thing that you can do as a student is be wise enough and smart enough to take what you need to take from who you need to take it from and leave what you don't need, you know. You can't just take everything and regurgitate it. You can't just internalize everything. You have to metabolize it, and you have to digest it, and then make it your own. And so, I'm not trying to dodge your question, but I think in my case, I was very lucky because I had so many great, great mentors and teachers and examples, and I had been allowed the privilege of, you know, taking what I wanted to take from each one of them and sort of assimilating it in my own musical being, which made me unique. And I had teachers who encouraged that. So, you know, I think that's really the key to being a great teacher and student, that relationship. There's a lot of responsibility that has to happen on both sides.
How much music, Jeremy, do you listen to? Do you listen a lot, or are you working within the silences of what you're working on?
Yeah, no, after a day of practice, I don't tend to put on the, except occasionally, maybe more often now, I listen to some great jazz musicians, especially Nina Simone, who I consider to be one of the great not only musician, but pianists of the last century, actually. If you listen to her playing, it's kind of astonishing, the control and the responsiveness and the musicality of every attack, you know, the vivid sense of what the harmonies are doing. You know, and she wanted to be, you should, and I'll put in a shameless plug for this documentary on Netflix about her, What Happened to Miss Simone. Did you see that or something?
Mm-mm, no.
And her dream was to be a classical musician, to do what, you know, we do and go to Curtis. And because of unknown factors, possibly including racial discrimination, she didn't end up going to the school she wanted to, and she built this amazing career. But it still troubled her, I think, always. So she's a fascinating case. And I listen to her a lot because I just think the music making is so gutsy and powerful.
And she just was given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys, the Grammy Award, just 2 days ago.
Oh, God, I didn't even know that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Finally.
Nina was.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm so out of the loop. I apologize.
Please don't. I was gobsmacked. Mm-hmm. Actually, my response was it took them this long, but that's another story for another day.
Mm-hmm. So that's time to answer. That's who I listen to usually.
I want to thank you both for coming in.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you in the room. Thank you to Jeremy Denk and RPO Music Director Ward Stair for being here. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.